This is our last week for the year, and we're featuring some of our most popular guests from 2017. And today, it's Daniel Kish. Daniel was recommended to us by a former guest, Julianne Bell, who talked a lot about her life as a blind person and how meeting this man, Daniel, had changed everything for her. Daniel Kish is also blind, and he lives a very outdoorsy kind of life in the United States. He climbs trees, he goes camping alone in the wilderness, he travels all over the globe, and he rides a bike through traffic. Daniel Kish is known as the Batman for his technique of using sharp tongue clicks to navigate his way through the world with an ease that seems astonishing to sighted people. This sonar technique that's called echolocation gave Daniel far greater independence than most people expected for him or even wanted for him. Daniel Kish is the founder and president of World Access for the Blind, an organization devoted to the self-directed achievement of people with all forms of blindness. I spoke to Daniel when he was in Australia earlier this year to do some workshops. Hi, Daniel. I'm so pleased to have you on this program.
I'm delighted. Thanks for having me.
Let's start right with your childhood. Not long after you were born, how did your mum notice that there was something wrong with your eyes?
There was a sparkle in them, and it wasn't just the sort of childlike sparkle of a baby's eyes. It was an unusual sparkle. So the tumors, as they develop, sparkle, especially when they're photographed. And so I'd say by about the age of 4 or 5 months, she noticed something was wrong. Her concerns were dismissed at first and then recognized. And they removed the first eye at the age of 7 months for a biopsy to determine what exactly was wrong. Once they determined what was wrong, they set about trying to treat the second eye. That was unsuccessful, so they removed the second eye when I was 13 months old.
What was wrong with your eyes? What, you mentioned a tumor?
Yeah, it was retinoblastoma. So very aggressive retinal tumors that don't take prisoners, really. So something needs to be done decisively and quickly, or there's metastasization and all sorts of grisly
consequences.
Yeah, impact. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm.
But clearly it worked because you're still here after all this time.
Once the eyes were removed, everything was fine, and I am still here.
Do you have any memory of sight at all?
I have no memory of sight. I was quite young. I do have memories going back quite young, but not that far.
What were you told happened? What you did when you came out of surgery? How old were you when you had all this done?
I would have been about 13 months old, and of course I don't remember, but the story goes that I awoke from the surgery early, unexpectedly early, and was found wandering around the intensive care nursery. I had climbed out of my crib, I would guess, to figure out where I was and what was going on. And I was found wandering, and in a sense, I've not stopped wandering.
Not since that day, no. How were your parents coping after the surgery?
Well, after the surgery, it was a relief. It's before the surgery that there are all the tensions. And once things were decided, and once it became clear that I was going to live, then everyone relaxed and set about raising me, which they did with a casualness that is a bit unusual with blind children. My parents were quite young. So my mother was 18, my father was in his early 20s, both were high school educated, and they really flew by common sense when working with me. Their assumption was he should grow up to enjoy the same freedoms and responsibilities as others, as an equal citizen to others, and to prepare him for this, to bring that about, we will raise him as normal as possible. And that's really what they did.
I wonder if the circumstances of how you became blind had a factor in this. I mean, the fact that, yes, you'd become blind, but your life was saved. So that was a kind of a relief rather than a catastrophe, perhaps.
You know, I'm told that my parents were not churchgoers, either of them, but when tragedy strikes, we have a funny way of visiting church sometimes. And they did. And my mom tells me that they prayed for me, My mom prayed that I would live. My dad prayed that I would see. And in a way, I ended up doing both, even though both eyes were removed.
When did you start clicking?
So as I understand it, it was soon after my second eye was removed. But it's not clear exactly when, because it would have been fairly subtle. What was not subtle, I think, though, was that I seemed to know what was around me. I seemed to know where I was going, what I was doing. I did not have anxiety about moving through space. What my mom will say is that when the second eye was removed, it slowed me down, but not very much and not for very long. So I seemed to regain an ownership of my surroundings. And probably by about 15 to 18 months, it was understood that the clicking had something to do with that.
And this clicking sounds just like that, is it? All right, yours is much sharper than the noise I just made, isn't it? I've made a kind of a vague, but yours is like, it's got a real snap to it.
It's practiced.
Right. Wow. That's got a real thud to it, that does. So using that, you just did that kind of naturally and kind of automatically, it seems.
Yes. I think for me, it developed in much the same way that language develops. I think that...
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. It was as if I was having a conversation with my surroundings. So when one clicks like that and knows what to listen for, what you hear is the environment answering back. So what I tell students now is that with every click, you are asking two questions of your environment. You're asking, where are you and what are you? And the more clearly you ask those questions, the clearer will be the responses.
So when you're a little kid, it must make the world like an enchanted place, because it's like, you know, Beauty and the Beast, where everything's animated and alive and talks to you in the way it talks. It gives you information.
It was very true, very true. And I related to the world in that way. I think it's that wonder, right? That wonder of childhood. So sighted children will do the same thing. They'll look around and they'll smile and they'll make faces and everything is new and different and interesting. And for me, it was very much that way, clicking and then moving to make determinations about what I was hearing.
When you were around about the age of 2.5, you said you were having trouble sleeping regularly. Has that sleep pattern got to do with the loss of sight?
It does. It's very common for those whose eyes have been enucleated. So the regulatory function of sleep is disrupted, as it was for me. So I've always had difficulty sleeping. As a child, I had difficulty getting to sleep. So I'd spend long hours, either tossing and turning or playing quietly in my room such that no one would hear me. And there is a story. Well, I remember parts of it. So parts of it I remember and parts of it are filled in. But my door had been locked. A chain had been put on my door because I had a tendency to leave the room. And a screen was on the door so you could hear and see in. So I'd apparently developed the capacity to move very quietly so as not to wake anyone. But I think I got bored of doing that and decided to leave my room. Couldn't leave by the door, so I left by the window. And I would have climbed up on a two-level toy box to reach the window. I don't specifically remember moving the toy box, but I do remember dangling from my arms and dropping into the flower bed outside the window. I distinctly remember the pebbles underfoot as I came down and played in the backyard for a while until I got bored of that, and then found my way to the fence surrounding the yard. It was a wire chain link fence, and clicking through the fence, and just, it was a very quiet night, and it was very easy to notice objects through the fence, large structures, things basically through the fence, and wondering what was over there. So it was a simple matter to climb over the fence. It's very simple when you're a toddler, to climb over the fence and begin exploring on the other side. And so one fence led to another, and I don't know how far down the block I was before someone discovered me marauding around their back garden.
2.5-year-old blind kid.
I was, and it would have been dark. It would have been 2 or 3 in the morning, and the police were called to have me returned home.
Wow, that's kind of amazing. Now there would perhaps be some parents that after the terror of that and the discovery of that might want to manacle you to your bed at night. That's after that. I mean, sighted or blind, I mean that's kind of terrifying.
A different lock put on the window. I mean, it's interesting. There were many, many episodes of me wandering away or discovering this, exploring that, running into things, whatever it was. It wasn't that my parents were derelict. It was just that they let me be a boy. And so, and especially in those days, boys were, dare I say, a bit more boyish than they are today. Yeah. And so we were quite rough and tumble, and it wasn't uncommon at all for kids to have injuries or bumps and bruises or what have you from climbing trees or falling out of this or, you know, falling over that.
So, yeah, kids used to show up at school with broken arms.
That's it.
You know,
and
I
remember this, kids with broken arms, kids on crutches. And I'm not saying that we should
right.
let our kids break their arms or whatever, but I think we swung far too far the other side. And I was very fortunate to grow up in an era when children were allowed to be children, and as I was. So so there were those episodes of me learning about the world in my own way, on my own terms, which included learning some of the harder lessons.
Now, I don't know how easy it is to know this, Daniel, but is it common for children who are born blind, who become blind very young, to start clicking just automatically like you did?
Yes, it's not uncommon. The stories that we hear are when we work with our clients are things like I used to do this, I remember doing it, but I was stopped. Or parents will say the same thing. Yes, little Jimmy used to click when he was little, but then he stopped doing it. Or, you know, we were told that it wasn't a good thing or whatever, you know. For a number of reasons, kids will often instinctively make clicks or clap their hands or stamp their feet or find other ways to send signals into the environment for information.
So why are they stopped from doing that?
I think it's a number of things. Obviously, it's a lack of understanding of what's going on. It's a concern about behavior. So it's a concern about abnormal behavior.
Oh, like you're weird enough, kid. Stop making these
something
weird noises.
Something like that. Yeah. Why are you doing that? Why are you doing this? I mean, there's a lot of attention paid to behaviors that we label blindisms, for example. And so this is often kind of misunderstood as a, quote, blindism, unquote. The other thing, though, is that I dare say that society is not quite ready for blind people to take responsibility for their own freedom, and not ready for blind children to do so. So there's often a custodialism that is imposed or put in place with the idea that the movements of a blind person need to be monitored somehow, or prescripted, or structured in some way, and that it takes a sighted person or sighted people or some kind of sighted supervision to ensure that the movements of blind people are safe, are somehow best done. So
yeah, so this is the thing I realized when I was talking to Julianne Bell, and when I heard you talking in the past, Daniel, I don't think I realized until then how much the anxiety of sighted people like me, I've done this too, is a problem for blind people. Really, if we're insisting on this kind of excessive custodialism, as you're talking about, that's for our benefit, not for yours, isn't it? So we don't feel so anxious.
I think it is. I mean, I definitely think that it's that it arises out of sighted concerns, the extensive overuse of sighted guide, for example, the idea that a blind person either needs to be attached to someone or needs to be connected to a surface. It's often said so that you are safe or that you feel safe, but really it's about the security, the sense of security of others around blind people. And also, I believe that fear of the dark and fear of the unknown are among man's most primal fears. So blind people are, in essence, that fear personified. And I think it strikes a kind of terror into the hearts of sighted people. And it's that that kind of motivates, well, a lot of things. It motivates the whole manner in which sighted people tend to approach blind people. And then, of course, that manner is projected onto blind people. It's inculcated by blind people, and blind people end up kind of absorbing those anxieties themselves and become anxious themselves.
Yeah, the same way you can, if you spend a bit of time in hospital, you can become quite institutionalized and sort of get used to all the extra care you get as a result.
That's it, and come to expect it and come to believe that it is necessary for your own well-being.
At home, as you were growing up, your dad was a troubled character. You said in the past that he drank a lot and was quite abusive. I wonder, funnily enough, if that was a factor in some ways, insofar as there's so much drama going on in the family that your blindness, since you don't want to make a big deal out of it, was a kind of a secondary issue or third order issue.
It really wasn't made a big deal of. The fact that I was blind was regarded as incidental. The fact that I could move around on my own without much concern was also regarded as incidental. My parents didn't know anything about blindness. They didn't have access to other blind people. For all they knew, this is just what blind kids did. So they just didn't think anything of it. And no extra attention was really given to my abilities at that time. And so I didn't regard them with any extra celebration either. As both of my parents were very pragmatic, they weren't really touchy-feely by nature, and they didn't express anxieties or sadness or any of the things that we often see. What they expressed was, right, let's get him moving, let's get him growing up. So that's what they did, and that's what my father did as well. My father was a bit more brash in his approach. His concern was really he wanted his boys, I do have a younger brother, he wanted his boys to be able to take care of themselves.
How did you learn to ride a bike? And how old were you when you did so, Daniel?
Well, that would have been my dad's idea. I always wanted to ride a bike ever since I saw older kids riding a bike. It looked, sounded very interesting. I mean, I had tricycles. I had all kinds of things that kids had, but bicycles were much more nimble and faster and much more interesting. So I discovered a small bicycle. It was quite a bit smaller than I was, and I was maybe 5 or 6 at the time. But it was great to learn the balance and to learn the movements and to learn how to direct the bike through space. So I started against a wall, and then I rode back and forth further and further away from the wall, clicking all the while, of course, and learning to balance the bicycle. And then one morning, I got up and basically fell over a bicycle that had magically appeared in the middle of my bedroom, and it was mine. It was for me, and it was something that my dad had acquired with the expectation that I would learn to ride it.
You see, today, maybe that would have child services rung. Some neighbor would ring up child services and say, these crazy parents have bought their poor blind kid a bike. They're encouraging their blind kid to ride a bike with heedless of the danger to him. How on earth did you learn how to ride this bike through traffic?
Well, okay, so to be fair, through traffic, we'll put air quotes around traffic.
Okay.
I did learn to ride in public roads. In those days, the public roads would have been a bit less trafficked than perhaps they are today. I lived in a rural residential neighborhood, so there wasn't tons of traffic.
But there were cars on the road.
Certainly there were cars on the road. And
cars move pretty quick. I mean,
they do, but they make noise. They make noise. So if a person is listening, if a person is attending to what they hear, it's difficult to be taken by surprise. So I could hear a car coming from a block away. There was never me being surprised by a car, whether it came from behind me, in front of me, around a corner. It didn't matter.
Now that you say that, the more I think about that, I think when I was riding a bike as a kid, I was doing that too, you know, because none of us have eyes in the back of our head.
That's it.
And you become a proper bike rider when you learn to hear a car coming a block away.
That's exactly right. And so I did that.
What about the cars coming towards you, though? That's got to be harder to judge. But then they're not coming towards you if you're in the right lane, I suppose. Is that how it works?
If you're in the right lane. Yeah. You hear those cars coming, right? So it doesn't matter if they're coming from in front of you or behind you, from the left or from the right. You know where they are. You hear where they're coming, and you adjust your trajectory accordingly.
Are you clicking while you're doing that, or is that meaningful?
No, the clicking is quite constant. So if I'm riding a bicycle that's... and it's a lot of head scanning, and it's constant spatial updating. Because the cars that are moving aren't actually the issue. I've ridden in full-on traffic. That's actually not very hard. What's hard are the things not moving.
The fast cars.
The things not making any noise. Those are, and they're not hard if the environment is quiet. They become difficult when the environment is not quiet. So at those speeds, it's difficult to get the range and sufficient spatial updating within the context of traffic noise. So as a rule, I don't ride in traffic. Not because riding in traffic is so hard, but because the surprises that could be placed in traffic are hard.
So this becomes like another sixth sense for you, if you like, as a kid. And I suppose when we're kids, we don't think about the nature of our senses, about what it is we're doing. We just receive the information and we don't question it. Who was it that helped you figure out that this clicking was a kind of a sonar, pinging out a sound that was coming back to you?
It's true. I didn't know. I didn't really think about it. None of us really thought about it or talked about it much. I moved schools to a neighborhood school quite close to me when I was about 10, and I began walking to school. So I walked to school from the age of 10 onward, and I had a friend who was a grade above me, but he was in my classroom. We had a fifth, sixth class, and he sort of took me under his wing. I guess I was sort of a novel project to him in a way, but we became good friends, and he came from a family of engineers, and he was very smart. We were in gifted classes, so we were both in a gifted class, and I was probably in there by the skin of my teeth, and he was probably several levels above me, but he was the one that pointed it out. So he was the first person, including teachers and professionals that I had known, who identified what was going on, and he explained the whole thing. He explained that here you're clicking, you're sending out sound waves. It's called sonar, which was a term I was not even familiar with because they always called it my radar. It's not radar.
No, it's sonar. That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And so he explained about submarines and bats and that sort of thing. So,
and did you think cool at that point, or what did you think?
I preferred the term radar. So at first I was actually resistant to the term.
Because that would make you like Daredevil then.
Right. Yes, yeah. Exactly. But he was correct. It was a sonar. And having had that introduction, I continued to use it, of course, through high school and into university, and then began studying it more formally as part of my master's thesis.
Did it ever let you down? Like crashing into things and falling off your bike and all that?
Well, has your eyesight ever let you down?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, of course.
The answer to that is a resounding yes.
But I suppose the further answer to that is, so what, I suppose. You know, we all have these pranks and crashes, no matter whether we're sighted or blind.
I have said, and it's followed me ever since I said it, that running into a pole is a drag, but never being allowed to run into a pole is a disaster.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
So you said you were put in a normal school, Daniel, when you were a kid. Were there other blind kids in that school?
Occasionally. there was a unit there where blind kids could be taught, at least in the earlier years, and then later, not at first, and then yes. But, you know, they weren't necessarily in my grade level, they weren't necessarily my age, so I had very little contact with other blind kids growing up.
When you did make contact with them, how different were they to you?
Without fail, they were less mobile, which I found perplexing. They just had difficulty getting around, had difficulty moving around. They tended not to be aware of what was around them, and not that I was the most socially graceful by any stretch, but they were often more awkward, or at least seemed to have more challenges.
Were they more victimized, bullied by?
Yes, or overprotected. So it could go either way. In those days, we didn't have one-on-one aides, so there were no one-on-ones looking after anyone. So you were, you know, you just had to manage. And I suppose there was some bullying that went on. I had relatively little contact with them, so I couldn't really comment. There was one, though, who came into the fifth grade. We were at the same grade level, and he came from a school for the blind, and he had a very different background from myself. And he, I would say, became pretty bullied and victimized because he was more vulnerable, and he had more needs, and unfortunately he came into a situation where I had kind of set the standard in a way. So he had difficulty making that transition. Academically, he was very strong. His braille skills were at least as good as my own, but he really had no mobility skills to speak of, and his social skills were quite underdeveloped. So he struggled in that environment.
So you went to university, and tell me about the book that you found that was called The Making of Blind Men and the impact that it had on you.
That would have been as I entered my second master's program. So I had graduated with my master's in developmental psychology. I had done my master's thesis on echolocation. I had, quite by accident in a way, decided to become an orientation and mobility specialist, which is someone who teaches blind people how to get around. I was told that blind people weren't allowed in that field because it was presumed necessary for sighted people to teach blind people how to be blind.
Really? Wow.
So I would have been the first. I would have been the first one. And I found that, again, bewildering and intriguing. So it was in that program that I took a class in Perspectives on Blindness, obviously taught by sighted professors. And all the texts were written by sighted people, including The Making of Blind Men. But what was different about The Making of Blind Men is it was the first I had encountered the idea of blindness, of the roles of blindness being essentially a social construction. So it talked about how blind people were sort of, by virtue of culture and by virtue of the systems within a culture, cast in certain roles, cast in roles of recipients, cast in roles of passivity. And his research was extensive. He was a psychiatrist. Dr. Robert Scott was a psychiatrist, and he left no stone unturned in how he charted this process.
Yeah, what you're describing sounds a bit like racism, actually. I mean, it's a bit like, oh, you're from this culture, so you're going to be like that.
We would call it sightism.
Uh-huh.
And then the larger context would be ableism, which is sort of the in term right now. But basically, yes, all of the components thereof are the same as racism or sexism or or other isms. And when Robert Scott published the book, this would have been decades ago, he was reviled.
Reviled by whom?
Well, he was reviled by other organizations. He was reviled by blindness organizations. How dare he say these things? What does he know? How could he know? Basically, the book essentially said that, and he drew a dichotomy. It wasn't all organizations. He drew a dichotomy, a distinction between the organizations that imposed the quote-unquote blind man role and those who didn't do so, but rather, for lack of a better word, empowered blind individuals to find their freedom. So he drew that distinction, but he was very clear that the majority of organizations that were publicly funded fell into this casting of the blind man role on blind individuals.
So this idea of the blind man and woman, that's the basis on which all this institutional care is built on. And the people who work in that, this is his argument, I'm saying.
Custodialism. Yeah. So it's basically about custodialism. It's basically about how blind people essentially need sighted people in order to function.
So when you say that role is just crap, you know, it's just an invented thing, and then you yank out the whole structure of all this institutional care for blind people, I suppose. Well, not all of it, but a large part of it, ideas, the presuppositions it's based on.
The basis of World Access for the Blind is not necessarily to yank it out, although, I mean, it all has to be restructured. So there's a major paradigm shift that needs to happen if these institutions want to be effective. If they don't make that shift, very likely they're going to crumble, because it's now very clear that other methods based on personal development, based on self-development, based on what I call freedom first, are more effective and, frankly, less costly. So either the face of institutionalization needs to change or fall and be replaced.
I'd like to do something horribly invasive now, Daniel, and get inside your head and see how you see the world. Try and imagine how you perceive the world, see the world. Would you call it seeing? What would you call that anyway?
Well, I've always called it seeing, mm-hmm. Because I've always felt that I see, because what I have in my head are images. They are spatial images. I call it three-dimensional fuzzy geometry. So there is depth, there is dimension, there is breadth to the world. There isn't color per se, but there are distinctions of surface density, texture, quality, characteristics. So the environment is really quite rich with all of those elements.
How much can you see in this room that we're in now?
Well, I could tell immediately that that the studio's fairly typical in terms of size, mm-hmm. and in terms of dampening, although it might have a bit less dampening than some.
Yeah, that's right. You said that as you went towards the big glass window, which we really shouldn't have in this studio.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that's where much of the reflection would be coming from. Uh-huh. And that there's not much more room in the studio than for this table, basically, table and chairs.
Do you get a sense of me in the room, like my apart from my voice, but a sense of my mass or presence, or is that too fuzzy at this stage?
No, I do get a sense of mass, and yes, you are fuzzy. I have an instructor who went blind later in life and learned to echolocate quite well, and he describes people as beautiful blobs.
So that's nice.
You are a beautiful blob, Richard.
I am so flattered. how does surfaces sound different? Like, I suppose you get less of a sound back from softer surfaces than you do from harder
That's
ones.
It. So, I mean, anyone can do this. If you aim your voice at a glass window, for example, it will sound harsh coming back to you. And then you move to a curtain, it will sound softer. Or if you walk into a closet, a wardrobe, your voice will sound soft, and then go walk into the washroom, it'll sound more echoey and reverberant. So these are extreme examples. But for me, and for those who learn to echolocate, all surfaces cast those distinctions. So every surface returns its own voice, if you will. And what we've learned from the brain scan studies is that it's the visual cortex that learns, that becomes activated to process those signals into visual images.
So it's your visual cortex that's processing this information by and large?
It is. So scans show this, not only for me, but for others who have been trained to do this or have learned to do this through experience, who use echolocation as a principal means of navigation. The visual cortex is active. It's clearly functioning in response to this information.
Are we talking about here something that's a bit like a very extended sense of touch? Are you touching us? Are you touching me?
it's often experienced like that. But it isn't in a sense, because if I click, what's essentially happening is air is moving, so it's called a compression wave, and it does touch you. It touches you in a very real sense, and it returns to me with information about you. So yes, I've never really thought of it that way, but you are touched by every click that a blind person emits.
You'd like to spend a lot of time in the country, and it gets dark in the country. There aren't street lights. Are there times when you're with a group of people and you are easily the most expert person to move through the landscape when it's in the dark?
It's happened, yeah. I'll sometimes hike with friends or whomever. I mean, I hike alone most frequently because I like being alone, but I also have friends with whom I like to hike. And I've had it happen several times, actually, where we'll be hiking and it'll grow dark and they become less confident and more cautious about their movements. And I know they have a flashlight, and I'll ask, you know, would you like to stop and get your flashlight going? And they'll say something like, no, I'm just following you. So they're following me through the wilderness. And then what will happen is there will become points where they become more confident, their stride length increases, and they become less cautious. And those would be points where a bit of starlight or moonlight might show through a canopy or whatever. So I kind of liken echolocation to a kind of starlight, which gives recognition to one's surroundings and allows for more confident management of those surroundings and of ourselves within those surroundings.
That's very poetic too. Do people ever challenge you when you're moving through the world? Do they go, whoa, whoa, tiger, slow down. Don't you need help? Don't we need to, you can't do that. You mustn't do that. Stop that. Stop, stop, stop.
Well, they sometimes try. you do come up against those social mores that we encounter regularly, where people will impose or try to impose restrictions. I think I project a leave me alone signal, but we certainly encounter that regularly with our students. They hear it all the time: slow down, slow down, be careful, be careful. And we have to sort of peel that away, unlayer that layer, so that they can develop their own freedom and their own relationship with their own surroundings.
Now, tell me about one of your first students with this foundation, a kid who lived in an apple orchard near Washington, please.
He was losing his vision. So he began losing his vision at about the age of five, and his world was sort of constricting around him, and he became more and more anxious and sort of confined himself more and more to his house. He wouldn't leave his house without an escort, and would prefer not to leave his house at all. So,
and this is what, a 10-year-old kid?
He was 10 years old by the time I began working with him. And I had opportunity to stay there for about a week or 10 days. And the parents were frantic. Nothing was really working with him, and they were very concerned. So I kind of pulled out all the stops and sort of became a sort of modern Ann Sullivan, if you will, with this boy as my Helen Keller. And one of the things we did, and the parents endorsed this, was this tree that we picked, that we selected. It was a birch tree. It was extremely climbable, but very tall, very high. So you climb this tree and you get a sense of accomplishment because it's just so huge. And he lived on an apple orchard and didn't know the first thing about how to find a tree, let alone climb one. So anyway, we embarked on this tree climbing lesson, and he became quite resistant a few meters up. And I had this feeling like this was a barrier that really needed to be broken. So I offered to help him. I basically said, I will help you every step through this process, but turning back isn't an option. And we can take as long as is needed, but the only option is to continue forward. And I had
continue up, you mean?
Yeah, continue upward. And I had a screaming child on my hands, but he did it. He did it. And by the time we reached the top, I had brought a picnic with me. And we actually have a video taken from the roof of a house. This tree was 60 feet tall or so. So the video is taken from the roof of a house of him smiling and eating a candy bar at the top of this tree.
Sorry, you were in the tree with him then, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we both climbed together. Right. We both climbed together. And he went on later to begin a process of stepping out of his comfort zone. He joined Boy Scouts, for example, in the local neighborhood, and he'd go out into the community. So it really was kind of a no-holds-barred, you're locking yourself in your room is not an option. So my idea at this point, I mean, obviously I've evolved a bit in my approach since then, we're talking 15 years ago, is a deep respect for personal freedom. It's a freedom of informed choice. It's a freedom of knowing what you're choosing and why. And so I wanted it to be very clear that this child understand what he's choosing. And of course, he chose not to climb trees, but he also chose not to lock himself away.
There was a boy you helped in Mexico. His name is Daniel, like yours as well.
Yes, he lost his
vision at the age of six. Tell me about him.
He was about the same age when I began working with him. Yeah, he was run over by a gas truck, and his body was pretty much total. They spent 2 days putting him back together. He made a full recovery except for his vision. By the time we began working with him, one of my instructors, Juan Ruiz, was with me translating. I wasn't speaking Spanish at the time, or very little. And we began teaching him to click, which he began absorbing very quickly. And the lessons moved on to soccer. So we involved him and the other children in games of soccer. And he just very quickly became a monster on the field. He loved it. We put the ball into a plastic bag so that it would make enough noise to track. And it did make enough noise to track. And so he got really good. And when he had gone blind, he lost status in his community. He just became sort of the outcast. And over the remaining two visits, so there were three in total, he reclaimed his status in the community. He became a boy that that other people wanted on their team, and that other people turned to him for answers. On the last visit, he'd be 12 by then. And he was playing quite well with his neighborhood compañeros. We were playing, and the bag came off the ball and was irreparable. And he continued playing even without the bag, and he was still quite good. But a boy had ridden past on his bicycle and saw that Daniel was playing without the bag on the ball. And he shows up with a bag in hand at the fence. And he'd taken the initiative of riding home, grabbing a bag, and bringing it back to the field. And that experience was in 2005, was pretty much the definitive experience that assured me that I was on the right path, even though this path has been very, very difficult and fraught with just a lot of struggle and challenge, because not only did Danielle show this remarkable fortitude of recovering himself, but he brought around himself his own community, and it became sort of this model of what would the world be like if it were like this.
The last couple of years, I spent a bit of time going back and forth to Iceland. And one of the things that you, as a sighted person, know in Iceland, it takes you a while to notice this, is the absence of street signs. It's signs telling you to be careful of this, don't do this, step off the travel later, you know, all this stuff that's there to warn us all the time. And it reminds me of the kind of Australia of my childhood, when there wasn't so many constant warnings all the time. Does the risk-averse world that we live in today make your work harder, Daniel?
Most certainly. We have become a society governed by fear, a society founded in fear. And it's harmful to us all. It's harmful to our children. It's turning us into limp people who no longer know how to make their own decisions, who no longer have the grit to abide by decisions that need to be made. And it hits blind children hardest, because blind children, and indeed blind adults, are categorized as at risk, as an at-risk vulnerable population. So they get hit particularly hard with strictures around duty of care and health and safety, etc. So yes, it most definitely makes our job harder.
Does the system punish parents for encouraging independence in their blind children?
It can. I mean, we've seen cases of child protective services being called. There was one woman here in Australia whose son it was blind, and she had to fight for him not to have an aide. She did not want him having a one-on-one aide in school, and she won. But she had to go through the process of fighting the system to make sure that an aide wasn't attached to him.
So much of what you've been talking about today is based on your idea of freedom. When do you feel most free, Daniel?
Probably when I'm hiking, really. When I'm out in the wilderness hiking alone. I have my own cabin up in the mountains above Sierra Madre in California. I've hiked in many different places, but that's one of my favorites. And just hiking, camping, tree climbing, just between myself and nature, birds, the sky, the water. That's probably when I feel most free and most at ease.
The idea of climbing to the top of a 60-foot tree, I cannot, in my mind, dissociate that with the queasiness of seeing how far I am from the ground. It'd be a different thing entirely for you, wouldn't it?
You know, as a kid in particular, I liked to poke my head out through the branches and click at the ground and see how far up I'd have to be before I couldn't really hear the ground anymore. And then what's magic to me is being at the top of a tree and hearing nothing but sky on all sides, hearing birds flying around you, beneath you. From that vantage point, you can hear for miles. So, I mean, you can hear what's going on in people's homes. You can hear what's going on out across, if you're in a city, out across the city. If you're in the mountains, so much the better. So it is a panorama that is very palpable from those heights.
I'm so glad we got this opportunity to speak with you, Daniel. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Daniel is president of World Access for the Blind. And thanks again to Julianne Bell for putting us in touch with Daniel. And there's a conversation with Julianne on our website too, if you'd like to hear more about the practice of echolocation.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
abc.net.au/conversations is the website for this program. All of our thousands of podcasts are available for you for free. And we have a Facebook page as well that I don't mention nearly enough. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.